This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
These two gentlemen, who are two military foxes guarding the democratic transition henhouse, that's a recipe for disaster. They conspire to steal the fruits of the revolution from the people, and now they have turned on each other.
That's Kweku Nuoma, professor of international politics at American University here in Washington, on the clash between Sudan's General Borhan and General Dagalo. Details coming up. Also, U.S. President Joe Biden will seek re-election. And Russia threatens to scrap an initiative that enables the safe export of grain from Ukrainian Black Sea ports. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A U.S. brokered three-day ceasefire between Sudan's warring generals seems to be holding, despite sporadic clashes after previous truces quickly failed. People in the capital are using lull in fighting to restock supplies or evacuate, as Michael Atit reports from Khartoum, Sudan.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Monday announced that Sudan's warring parties had agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire. Blinken said the agreement between the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, began following intense negotiation over the past 48 hours. The United States urges the SAF and the RSF to immediately and fully uphold the ceasefire, Blinken said. He said the U.S. will coordinate with the regional and international partners and Sudanese civilian stakeholders to help create a committee aimed at forging a permanent cessation of hostilities and humanitarian arrangements in Sudan. In a written statement Monday, the RSF said it had agreed to the truce in order to open humanitarian corridors, facilitate the movement of citizens and residents, enable them to fulfill their needs, reach hospitals and safe areas, and evacuate diplomatic missions. We also call on the international community to intervene and put pressure on the Sudanese army to abide by the terms of the ceasefire, the RSF said in a tweet. There was no immediate official statement from the Sudanese army on the U.S. brokered ceasefire. In Khartoum, civilians ventured out to buy food and supplies on Tuesday or packed into vehicles to flee the city, seeking safer places to wait out the clashes which began on April 15th. Evacuation of diplomatic mission from Khartoum continued for a third day. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan said in a statement that some 700 UN and international non-governmental organization staffers and their dependents have reached Port Sudan by road. More than 70 other international aid workers have already been evacuated from Al Janina in West Darfur and Zalinje in Central Darfur to Chad. In response to the security situation in Sudan, the United Nations had temporarily relocated its internationally recruited personnel from Khartoum to Port Sudan. But Volker Perthes, the head of the United Nations Integrated Transition Assistance Mission in Sudan, or UNITAMS, remains in Khartoum despite the war. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
The UN Refugee Agency is making plans for hundreds of thousands of people spilling over Sudan's borders to escape violence. UNHCR official today told the Geneva briefing they are poised for 270,000 people to flee, a preliminary planning figure that includes those crossing into South Sudan and Chad, as well as South Sudanese returning home. In Chad, Halima Isaac Umar fled Tendalati, Sudan. She says there is no security in Sudan, so she fled to Chad. She says they came with nothing and need many things to survive. Omar says they will have to rely on UNHCR for help. UNHCR's estimate for refugees from Sudan so far only covers two of Sudan's seven neighbors. Projections for Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Central African Republic, and Libya are not yet ready. Sudan itself hosts more than 1 million refugees, many of whom have fled conflicts in neighboring countries such as South Sudan. In addition, 3.7 million of its own people are internally displaced, UN data shows. Samvura Habamungu is head of a UNHCR sub-delegation in Chad. He said many of the women crossing to Chad said they need food urgently. Havamungu says the people who came from Goita have nothing. They lost everything. Everything was torched on the other side, and the woman told us they need food. He also says the need for clean water is very urgent. We must do something because there is a risk of waterborne diseases like dysentery and diarrhea. At the UNHCR meeting in Geneva, officials said the agency is working closely with partners and governments in the region to assess the need of the refugees and expressed gratitude that neighboring nations are keeping borders open. UNHCR also is bolstering supplies of key aid items, including sleeping mats, soap, and cooking utensils. It's been more than a week now since tensions between Sudan's two most prominent generals exploded into full-blown battles that have sprawled across the country of some 46 million people, turning the teeming capital Khartoum into a ghost town and triggering a wave of refugees fleeing for safety. Chaos, lawlessness, and fear have gripped much of Sudan. Kweku Nuwama, professor of international politics at American University, tells me this crisis is unfortunate as it was not unexpected. He points out that when two military foxes are guarding the democratic transition hen house, that is a recipe for disaster.
I hope that somehow the parties involved and their allies and the international community and the African Union can find a way to get a quick ceasefire and force the parties back to the negotiation table, and somehow we can avoid further escalation and further pain to the people of Sudan. This is an unfortunate conflict, but it was not unexpected because the way the transition happened, first of all, when you get rid of an entrenched dictatorship, it takes a while to fully move on from this. And then you had essentially these two gentlemen who are two military foxes guarding the democratic transition hen house. That's a recipe for disaster. They conspire to steal the fruits of the revolution from the people, and now they have turned on each other, and they are bringing pain and misery to a lot of people in Khartoum and other parts of Sudan. And very soon, if this conflict is not stopped, it's going to impact a lot of people in the region, and it can actually escalate into a full-scale sub-regional conflict.
But what can you do when these two generals, Burhan and Hemeti, are in a collision course? They have vowed to defeat each other with unprecedented scenes of violence gripping Khartoum.
Well, that appears to be the conundrum. But remember, both of these sides are getting support from outsiders, not only here, but in Africa as well. So one thing that, if you look closely at what's happening in Sudan, this idea that African leaders grow parallel security forces, because the rapid response forces, they come out of the Janjaweed militia that the Bashir government created to fight the Darfurian rebels. And so Africa, you have this, so you have a regular army, but then the government goes behind the regular army and starts up a militia that it uses to do all kinds of stuff. And then they become as strong as the army. And so when you try to take away their power, they start fighting because, you know, Hemeti is using these guys. He's making money. He controls Darfur. He's, you know, essentially leasing them and fighting for the Saudis in Yemen. And this is all Bashir created this stuff by essentially creating a private, you know, irregular army to do his bidding. You know, we can't keep doing stuff like that. And so Africa, you know, we're not serious.
And the same thing happened like in Ethiopia very recently between Oromo, the Tigray militia, the Amhara militia. They become stronger, like you said, than the government's army.
Yeah, and absolutely. Ethiopia is going to have to deal with that. They're trying to, you know, now take away, trying to fold all of them to the national army.
Yes.
Why do you have regional armies? Why? Burkina Faso, a similar thing happened in Burkina Faso, because Burkina Faso, the presidential guard regiment, who was essentially a private army for Blaise Compaoré. And so this is what happens in all this. Even Ghana had one of those in the Rawlings years. Because what they do is that they hollow out the military. They fund these private paramilitary forces that they use to do all kinds of stuff. But then eventually the state has to figure out a way to bring them in. And in this case, you have, you know, a paramilitary force that's stronger than the national army. You know, the danger is if Hemeti is not defeated, he's probably going to retreat into Darfur. He's from Darfur. He's going to retreat into Darfur, where his bases are, where he controls the gold, and he's going to be there, and he's going to be a regional warlord. And then we get into a full-scale civil war, because at this point, it's really just a power struggle between two military guys. But if he retreats into Darfur and he holds that, he's trying to unseat the government now, because most of his attacks has been in Khartoum. But if he decides that he can't win in Khartoum and he retreats into Darfur and he holds that region, you got a problem. You got a problem, because there's a lot of money there. And that's where the Russians are. The Wagner is over there. You know, they're getting a lot of the Sudanese gold from that area. If he retreats over there and he holds that, you're going to get a civil war.
That was Kweku Nuama, professor of international politics at American University. He spoke with me from Washington. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. U.S. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris today said they will run for re-election in the 2024 presidential race. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wida-Kusawara spoke with my colleague Kate Bond-Dawson a short time ago to explain what's next in the lengthy U.S. election process.
Essentially, now that he's announced that he's running again, President Joe Biden can essentially campaign again, right? And the first target for the campaign is what's called the primary election. So in the U.S., we have the primary system where each state holds an election essentially to figure out who from each party will be running for the party. So far, we don't see any kind of contenders, anybody running against President Biden within the Democratic Party. I mean, there are one or two candidates, but they're not thought of as any kind of serious considerations. And the first election that will be held in next February in the primary of the state of South Carolina. This is a different and a new thing in the 2024 presidential election calendar. Usually it's Iowa. That's always the first state in the nation. But this year, President Biden said, nope, we're going to change it. We're going to have South Carolina first. The argument that he put forward was that this is a state that more represents the diversity of Democratic voters. There are a lot of Black and Brown voters. But, you know, the cynical view is that there are a lot of Biden supporters in South Carolina. Therefore, having the primary there first will give him the momentum to move along in the primary schedule. So that's what's next, campaigning and then the primary election.
What sort of support does Mr. Biden have both among the Democratic Party leadership and then just average voters?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, right? I mean, President Joe Biden is not enjoying a high popularity in poll after poll. There's a new NBC News poll that says 70% of Americans believe that he should not run for re-election, and that includes 51% of Democrats. This was a poll that was taken one or two weeks ago, so before the announcement. But on the other side, 60% of Americans, including a third of Republicans, say that Donald Trump, who is now the leading contender on the favorite coming out from the Republican side, should also not run for president. So we have this very interesting situation where both Democrats and Republicans say that they do not want Joe Biden and Donald Trump to meet again in a rematch. However, that's probably what is the most likely outcome that will happen, because there are no contenders on the Democratic side. It's almost, you know, guaranteed that it's a coronation of Joe Biden. And on the Republican side, at this point, Donald Trump is still the leading contender. Of course, there are many other factors. Number one is the indictment on Donald Trump, which may prove to be very distracting for his campaign, that Ron DeSantis or somebody else might take him over. We do not know at this point. However, what's also interesting is that both Democratic and Republican voters still say that they will vote for either Biden or Trump. 88% of Democratic voters say they'll definitely or probably vote for Biden, and about half of Republican primary voters say that they would support Trump. So in other words, this is a situation where the American public do not want to see a rematch between Trump and Biden, but if there is a rematch, they will still vote for their candidate because the alternative is just something that they cannot accept.
That was VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wida-Kusuwara speaking with VOA's Kate Bond Dawson. The presidential election will be in November 2024. The French news agency AFP reports President Cyril Ramaphosa says the governing African National Congress ANC party has resolved that South Africa should quit the International Criminal Court, which last month issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin. The warrant means Pretoria, which hosts the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa summit this year, would have to detain him on arrival. Ramaphosa said the decision, which follows a weekend meeting of the ANC, was reached largely because of what is perceived as the court's unfair treatment of certain countries. The arrest warrant for Putin followed accusations that the Kremlin unlawfully deported Ukrainian children. South Africa has refused to condemn the invasion of Ukraine that has largely isolated Moscow on the international stage. South Africa tried to withdraw from the ICC in 2016, a year after Sudan's then President Omar al-Bashir visited for an African Union summit. It refused to arrest him despite an ICC arrest warrant for alleged war crimes. Russia has threatened to scrap an initiative that enables the safe export of grain from Ukrainian Black Sea ports to the world market. The threat comes after members of the Group of Seven leading industrial nations warned they may impose further sanctions on Moscow over its invasion of Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The Group of Seven leading industrial nations are considering a near total ban on all exports to Russia, according to Japan's Kyodo News Agency, citing Japanese government sources. Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, said Sunday that if such a ban happens, Moscow will terminate the Black Sea Grain Initiative. That agreement, brokered by the United Nations and Turkey, enables the vital export of grain from Ukraine's Black Sea ports to world markets through the joint inspection of vessels at a facility in Istanbul. Ukraine is the world's fifth biggest producer. Around 28 million tons of grain have been exported under the deal since July. Experts warn its termination could have a devastating impact amid a global food crisis. Ian Mitchell is from the Centre for Global Development.
If the Black Sea deal isn't renewed and Ukraine can't export, then I expect to see food commodity prices to increase substantially again.
Russia had already said last month it might not renew the grain deal beyond its expiry on May 18th. Moscow says a separate but parallel memorandum of understanding it agreed to with the United Nations to help Russia's own agriculture sector in the face of Western sanctions is failing. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Friday, namely the removal of any obstacles to the export of Russian fertilizers and grain. Practically nothing has been done here. Despite that claim, figures show Russian wheat exports actually doubled over the past year. Among the Kremlin's demands are the return of the Russian Agricultural Bank to the SWIFT global payment system, the resumption of supplies of farm machinery to Russia, and the lifting of restrictions on insurance and access to ports for Russian ships and cargo. Professor Stephen Flynn is from the Global Resilience Institute at Northeastern University.
Certainly, those demands cannot be fully met, and the Russians know it. They're again trying to leverage the food to get all the concessions they can get. They're doing it at a time when it's almost certain that we're going to see an uptick in the conflict with the Ukrainians potentially trying to really push back the Russian positions.
So what if Russia does terminate the grain initiative? Again, Stephen Flynn.
if Russia clearly decides to be aggressive and mine the areas where the ships move, potentially target those ships, then the ships aren't going to move. Insurance rates would go very high. Decisions would be made by ship owners not to come into the Black Sea. And that would really put a strangle on the flow of grains.
The United Nations and the G7 have urged Russia to renew the grain initiative, warning that any disruption could significantly increase food prices and endanger lives in the world's poorest nations. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
Kenya's opposition says it will resume protests over the high cost of living, alleged economic mismanagement, and election fraud. Opposition leader Raila Odinga halted protests last month after President William Ruto promised to hold talks and reform the election commission. But Reuters reports that Odinga's Azimio la Umoja, or Declaration of Unity Party, says Ruto has not followed through. VOA spoke with three students at the Alliance Francaise, that is the French school in Nairobi, today to ask about their views on protests. Prudence says she'd like the protests to stop, but if there are renewed demonstrations, they should be peaceful. She says the opposition has already made their demands known. Now it's time for everyone to sit down, review, and negotiate.
If dialogue is not working, then they should maybe invite better leaders who can come in, if it's the UN or anyone who will have impact, to come and sit down with these leaders who are not agreeing on the table and now find a solution moving forward. Mediation is always mediation, negotiation, all those other forms of conflict resolutions are the way to go to make sure that we as a country are headed in the right direction without the protests.
Another student, Saloma, says the protests interfere with daily activities, with students forced to stay home and not go to school. She's also anxious for dialogue to take place. Demonstrations, she says, are not a good idea.
I don't think that's a good idea, because when protests take place, we have to stay at home. That means we don't go to work, we don't go to school. So it's an interference with our daily activities. I don't think it's a good idea. I think there should be a different way to settle. Maybe the president and the former prime minister can just sit together and reach some sort of agreement or negotiation so that we don't have all this. I think it can be settled in a peaceful way.
A third student, Beatrice, says continued protests are harming, not helping the economy, which needs to grow to improve living conditions.
Normally when there are those protests, there are so many things that are destroyed. Like one, businesses are not moving, and here in Kenya mainly, money needs to move from one hand to another. So if it's only if businesses are closed, money is not going to move and the economy is going to go down, as opposed to it growing, and we need to improve the livelihood of people living in Kenya and the citizens as well.
There's been no immediate comment from Ruto or his party to the announced resumption of protests. The opposition says it remains committed to dialogue, and some have suggested a potential role in governance. However, the president and his ruling Kenya Kwanza party are urging more time for him to turn around the economy. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.